will get started. We are studying church history. I think everyone who was here last time is here this time. We're going to be looking at some of the historical backgrounds that lead into the history of the church. And this could even really serve as an introduction to the New Testament in a way, since we see the beginnings of the church in the New Testament, and we see that the church came up at a specific time in history. There are differences between Judaism and world empires and all kinds of things from the time of the Old Testament to the time of the New Testament. So this can help us kind of understand the time period, the national statuses, and all these various things that led into the New Testament and then all the history that followed afterwards. So historical backgrounds, very important. So to introduce this topic, here we go. I'd like to read Galatians, actually. Galatians chapter 4, verses 4 through 5, and I'll just read it. When the fullness of time came, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, so that he might redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. And I wanted to highlight this phrase, when the fullness of time came. The Lord Jesus Christ came into a particular point in history, into a particular place that God had determined in God's sovereign plan to be the perfect time for him to come. The revelation of the Son came at the perfect time in history. All of history up to that point was leading up to the cross, the revelation of the Son, and everything that has happened since then has flowed from that. There's a reason even our years go back to that time of the cross, that time that Jesus walked the earth. Until then, we numbered things B.C., and now we number them A.D. It really is a central time in history that God had determined to send his Son. In God's eternal plan, it was the perfect time for Jesus to come in. It was the perfect culture. They were under the perfect circumstances. It was the perfect place, all of that, for the gospel to be spread into the world. One quote that I got from Philip Schaff, one of the sources, says this, and I thought it was pretty interesting. The history of mankind before his birth must be viewed as a preparation for his coming, and the history after his birth is a gradual diffusion of his spirit and progress of his kingdom. All things were created by him and for him. He is the desire of all nations. He appeared in the fullness of time, when the process of preparation was finished and the world's need of redemption was fully disclosed. So I thought that was kind of neat and kind of a fun way to introduce, recognizing that while we're looking at history and it might seem to be cold, dead facts at times, some of this background information might seem kind of dull to us. Christ came at the perfect time that God had determined for him to come. And it was, and everything led up to that. So everything was set up perfectly, and everything flowed perfectly from that, as far as God is concerned. So, anyway, before we get into it, I just want to remind anyone: if you had a question at any time, bring it up. Feel free to interrupt me, raise your hand, whatever else. I might not have the answer right away, but I promise I'll at least look into it and try to have an answer for you the next time. This is less formal than a Sunday morning is. Interaction is appreciated, so just wanted to let you know that as we went on. And if I go too fast with the slides, if you're taking notes or whatever else, just let me know and I can go back to a particular slide. So anyway, first, we need to understand the Greek world, the world that eventually turned into the Roman world, which was the context that the gospel went out into. Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither was its culture. So we need to see how that developed. And the Roman world was mostly inherited from the Greek world that was conquered by Alexander the Great. I'm sure we've all heard of Alexander the Great. He went out and conquered almost the whole world around the Mediterranean Sea at that time. A rather interesting figure in history. There are all kinds of books and movies on him. But Alexander, as he was spreading his culture, as he was spreading the Greek culture, what it was called at that time and now is Hellenization. Hellenization is the historical spread of the ancient Greek culture, religion, and to a lesser extent, the language over foreign peoples conquered by Greeks are brought into their sphere of influence. So it is this Hellenized culture that is spread throughout the world that is inherited by the Romans and that we even see in the times of the New Testament. In Acts, a couple chapters in, we read about the Hellenistic Jews. Well, who exactly are these people, the Hellenistic Jews? Why might it be that they're not being fed while the Jews from Judea are being fed? What were the differences between that? Well, Hellenism helps us kind of understand that. They were Jews who were Greeks by culture in a sense, but religiously Jewish. They had adapted the Greek culture, the Greek language, various practices while still maintaining their Jewish religion. And that culture was spread not just to Jews, but to everyone living in that region. So Hellenization, it's an important concept to understand. As I said, spread by Alexander the Great. He's the son of Philip II, a Macedonian ruler. He was a student of ethics, geography, philosophy. He studied under Aristotle, who also received intense military training that equipped him to take over basically the known world at that point. We can look and see what Alexander conquered. In 336 BC, when he was only 20 years old, he consolidated his father's power in Macedonia. You can see in the upper left-hand corner, an army of about 30,000 infantry and 4,500 cavalry. So he gathered them together and he launched a massive conquest throughout the world at that time. He conquered Asia Minor, Syria, Palestine, Babylonia, Persia, and northwestern India. It's said that Alexander never lost a battle. He was just this unstoppable force spreading over the world, and no one could stop him. He started at 20 years old. He died at only 33 years old. And in between that time, he's able to conquer all of this territory and spread the Greek culture throughout that entire territory. So, along with the conquering, he accelerated the spread of Greek culture. So the language, the philosophy, the religion was spread. That's why during New Testament times, most people are speaking Greek. That's why the New Testament was written in Greek. The Greek was kind of like the English of that day. It was the common language that everyone knew, at least as a secondary language, if not their primary language. So anyway, that's the world Alexander conquered. Alexander later died only at 33 years of age, and his empire kind of split up, and we see that a little bit here. It's not too terribly important to our course, but I thought it would at least be worth mentioning. While the empire split up, the culture largely remained the same and continued to spread. Hellenization influenced cities such as Alexandria in Egypt, influenced Antioch and Seleucia, and these were kind of became cultural capitals of the world. Later on, as we get into the spreading of the gospel and the centuries after the time of the apostles, we'll read about cities such as, we'll learn about cities like Alexandria and see how they were kind of cultural hubs. Judaism by then had spread to Alexandria as well, and many people, such as Origen, if you've ever heard of him, came from Alexandria. Athanasius, we'll learn about him, the great defender of the Trinity. He also came from Alexandria. And a lot of our ancient biblical manuscripts come from Alexandria. A lot of the oldest copies of the New Testament were found preserved in Alexandria. They had a massive library. It just became this massive center for information. Anyway, after, you know, Alexander the Great, he spreads the culture, and Rome eventually comes and takes over the land while the culture remains. So now we move into the Roman world. So a little bit of history on Rome. Rome was founded in 753 BC, traditionally. I mean, we can't get the exact dates, but that's the traditional dating by Remus and Romulus, and we may have heard the story of these guys raised by a wolf, a mother wolf, and they later founded the city of Rome. I'm sure there's all kinds of fascinating mythology that went into the founding of it, but traditionally that's what is said. By 265, it became the dominant state in Italy and continued to spread. Eventually, Rome conquered all the lands around the Mediterranean Sea. They went up into Gaul. They took over parts of Germany. They went as far as Spain by the time they got to their height of power. All that Alexander conquered, Rome reconquered, and then even more than that, Palestine, Israel, eventually came in under control of Rome in 63 BC through the conquering of the Roman general Pompey, and we'll get into a little bit more of that later as well. So, and here we have a picture of the Roman Empire at the height of its power, about 117 AD. Didn't look too terribly different during the time of Christ. So, but you can see how where Alexander, he kind of started up in here and took this, Rome, you see how much further that Rome had eventually spread out in conquering that empire, and along with it, the Hellenization went with it. They spread the language, they spread the philosophies and the religion. It really was a massive empire. So, a little bit about Roman government. Until about 510 BC, Roman provinces were ruled by kings, but later they became a republic ruled by a senate for the next several centuries until about 27 BC. During that time of it being a republic, there were all kinds of wars, conflicts, senators stabbing each other in the back, all kinds of crazy things like that, and it became apparent that there needed to be a central ruling authority, a centralized power in Rome, and that eventually led to Julius Caesar. So anyway, Julius Caesar, he was a soldier, he was a politician, he was a great warrior, a really charismatic guy, was set to be the ultimate ruler over Rome. He was kind of the chosen one for them to bring Rome under control, under one head of Julius, but people who were sympathetic to the old republic eventually assassinated him, so Brutus and Cassius. I think Shakespeare wrote a play on the assassination of Julius Caesar. It might be of interest to some folks. Anyway, with his death, a new series of Wars began. He ultimately didn't take the control that many hoped that he would. But it led to his nephew, there we go, Octavius. And we've definitely heard of him. He was Julius's nephew, and he began to rule Rome in about 31 BC to 14 AD. He's the Augustus that we read of in the New Testament. He was given this title Augustus that means exalted one. They almost deified him just as they deified Julius before him. The month of August is actually named after Caesar Augustus, a fun fact for you. And again, this is the same Caesar that's mentioned in scriptural accounts of the birth of Christ. We read in Luke chapter 2, verse 1, that in those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census to be taken all over the inhabited world. Augustus was seen as a savior from heaven. He was seen as divine. He was almost worshipped by his people because of the phenomenal power that he had in bringing the empire under his control. One early poet named Virgil said this of Augustus: "Behold the man, behold the promised one. You know him, Augustus Caesar, the son of a god. He is predestined to power and to restore the golden age to Latinum, the land where Saturn used to rule. His empire will swell beyond the Garamants and Indians over territory further than the stars of the zodiac and the yearly course of the sun." And he goes on and on. And he wrote more about Augustus too. So absolutely beloved, seen as a god. He was their great hope, their great divine savior. And it wasn't completely without cause. Augustus was probably the best of all the Caesars that would eventually rule Rome. In his earlier years, he was more ruthless. He had no problems with squashing his opponents through any means necessary, murder, espionage. Kind of a ruthless guy, but later on he wisened up a little bit. He became more generous. He became a more moderate ruler, and by the time he was out, he was probably had one of the greater characters of any of the Caesars that we eventually see. As we get further into history and we start to look at especially persecution, we'll see that they could be some pretty nasty guys. After Augustus, Rome would continue to be ruled by a single emperor for about the next 200 years, and eventually Rome begins to split apart, and we'll get into that as well. So this is the environment that the New Testament would be written in, under a single ruler who was often deified, a massive Roman Empire that could be freely traveled around, and that's what we're going to look at next. There's this phrase called Pax Romana, which means Roman peace. And it's under Pax Romana, that's what allowed the gospel to spread as freely as it did. Under Pax, there was universal political loyalty to the emperor under Pax Romana. There weren't various political parties all vying for control and tearing the nation apart. Everyone was loyal to the emperor. You didn't have to be worried that if you crossed the borders from one state to another, that the leaders there might hold to a different law and arrest you for some various reason. So generally there was political loyalty under the Caesars. And that led to there being relative peace throughout the empire, for the most part. There was a common economy of goods that can be spread out through the empire. If it were just a cluster of smaller nations, you imagine the trade would kind of be a nightmare. People could put up levies against each other, things like that. But with such a massive empire, anyone could really get anything that they wanted because everything was under control of the Roman Empire. Not a complete parallel today, but we can almost buy anything we want, right? All we have to do is hop on the internet, go to Amazon, and there might not be a factory here in Atlantic or even in Iowa for some type of product that we want, but we can still get it because in the United States, there's free trade. So there's kind of a parallel there. Made life very easy for them. Rome protected its empire very well. They protected them from the Persians from the east and the Germanic tribes that lived in the north. So while you're living centrally in the empire, you didn't have to worry about some kind of invading army come and destroying your village and stealing your livestock and whatever else. The Roman army was made up by Roman citizens as well as natives of the conquered lands, and they were constantly present throughout the empire. The Roman army wasn't simply made up by Romans. It could be stretched pretty thin, but others in the lands that they conquered could enlist, and that made the military a constant presence, making things pretty safe for the most part. If there's a region that was known for disturbances, well, the Romans could just send in the army, and everything would be taken care of. Throughout the Roman Empire, there was a common language and culture, and we talked a little bit about that already. The culture was left over from Alexander the Great and his conquest. It was a Greek culture, Hellenism, like I had mentioned. This culture was immensely popular to the Romans. It was a popular culture all around. The Romans, they might have taken over the land from the Greeks, but they looked at how they lived and they looked at the language and they said, yeah, this makes things pretty easy. I like believing these things. This is a pretty easy language to use. Most of the people already know it. And that culture that they took over was very easily adapted to Rome. So Latin was technically the official language of the government, and the more upper class people would speak Latin. Those in the western provinces would be more likely to speak Latin. However, throughout most of the empire, Greek, if not a second language, was a primary language among most people. And it was Greek that was so significant in spreading the gospel message because everyone knew the same language. If Paul is in Jerusalem and people are passing through town all the way from Rome, he can talk to them in a way that they can understand because of the common language. If Paul writes a letter from one city and then sends it hundreds of miles to another city, he knows that they're going to be able to read it because he's writing in the common language of Greek. Schaff has an interesting quotation on Greek. Greek, says Cicero, is read in almost all nations. Latin is confined by its own narrow boundaries. Under the protection of the Roman law, the apostles could travel everywhere and make themselves understood through the Greek language in every city of the Roman domain. So Latin, while it was a language of the higher classes, Greek was the language of the common people, especially in the Mediterranean area where the gospel first sprung up and began to spread. And again, that's why the New Testament is written in Greek. Yeah.
Okay, the Roman citizenship, yep, seems to have played a role in the fact that they could move around, and I know Paul used his citizenship sometimes. What was the source of the rights of the Roman citizen that made it easier for them to go from country to country and have the protection of with the Caesars, or did it come prior to the Caesars when they had the Senate and the...
That's something I'd have to look into, but we see with Paul that... You know, you could be born a Roman. I know there were certain cities that if you were born in, or if your parents had a certain heritage and you were born under them, you were a Roman citizen by default. Not everyone born in the Roman Empire was a Roman citizen by default. You could also purchase your Roman citizenship. And one of the, probably the biggest protection that it gave them is Paul didn't have to face unnecessary arrests or anything like that. I remember every single time he's arrested, he pulls out that card. Hey, I'm a Roman citizen. You can't treat me this way. And it probably played other roles too. Let's say an army's rolling through town and a guy grabs a random guy off the street and he says, here, you need to carry my shield with me for a mile. And the guy, he can't really do much about it. Are you going to say no to the Roman army? But I would imagine if that guy were a Roman citizenship, he could also pull that card and say, hey, you can't make me do that. I'm a Roman citizen. I'm your boss, so, and not the other way around. But I'll look into that, the citizenship of Rome, and I'll try to make mention of that next time as well. But yeah, it did make things a lot easier for Paul. He didn't have to be worried about... really anything. If he was wrongfully imprisoned, then they would make it right. If he weren't a Roman citizen, who cares? Who cares about the hoi polloi? But Roman citizen, that's a bigger deal. That's more upper class. So anyway, also Pax Romana also made it easier to travel, which, without saying, is incredibly important to the spread of the gospel. The Romans made a massive road system throughout their entire empire, and many of those roads are still standing today. The roads were generally pretty well protected. In other days, other times, when you're traveling, it was often a big risk because there would be bandits that would wait along the road to take everything you have and leave you for dead. But under the Roman Empire, if the armies are constantly patrolling the roads, they're pretty safe. I can travel without too much fear for my life that someone might come along. And it's far easier to spread a message that way as well. After the fall of Rome and the massive weakening of the Roman Empire, kind of starting to go into the Middle Ages, there is a massive slowing down of the spread of information and of travel because the roads weren't as safe anymore. During those days, it was normal for someone to never travel more than 7 miles away from the place that they were born throughout their entire life. But with the Roman roads the way that they were, it made it much, much safer to travel around. All right. Greek education and philosophy. So, Roman education and philosophy, again, with almost everything else, largely inherited from the Greeks. The writings of Homer and who all here has read The Odyssey? Did anyone have to read it for school or anything like that? We had to read it for school, so kind of an interesting book. I'm not sure how you can read that and come away with a large education, but they were largely influential in education. You know, people would grow up reading Homer, you know, kind of like how a few decades ago children would grow up reading the Bible. It's not quite so normal anymore, but that was just the book that you read. Why is it that English has largely stayed the same? Because when the Bible was first printed in English, that's what everyone read, and that's how they learned English. And the same way with Greek. They would read the classics, the Iliad, the Odyssey, and that's how many people would learn how to read. So Plato and Aristotle formed the basis for science and theology. It was through their influence. It still hung around throughout the Roman Empire, even though a lot of it was eventually replaced with Epicureanism and Stoicism, and we run into those a little bit in the New Testament. Paul actually addresses Epicureanism and Stoicism, but this can kind of help give us an idea of what these two systems are. They were kind of opposite philosophies that would bounce off of each other, kind of like Pharisees and Sadducees, how they had alternate views and they would always argue. Republicans and Democrats, can't get them in a room together without them arguing. So, and these were the two big philosophies of the day among the upper class. So Stoicism was all about finding happiness and self-control. You know, it's about not seeking after pleasures and things like that, but it's to live a virtuous life, and that's the best way to live. The Stoics didn't really believe in gods or a god or anything like that. Rather, they looked at the universe around them and said, well, this is God. I'm part of God. We're all part of God. That's what God is. That's the universe. And Hinduism has a very similar system of belief. Pantheism is what it's called. So, there's no personal deity God. Everything is just God. Everything is just part of the divine. There's only this matter around us, nothing spiritual beyond that. Epicureans, kind of almost the opposite. They were hedonistic, so they lived for pleasure. That's what they were all about, living for pleasure. It was the chief good in life, not only physical pleasure, but mental pleasure, growing, learning, and things like that. They rejected the idea of the afterlife. However, they did believe in the pantheon of gods. So, but they didn't think the gods had anything really to do with the world. Our world is in its own separate little realm, and the gods are in their own separate little realm, and the two don't meet. So kind of like a deism of our day, where God might have started things off, but he has nothing to do with anything that happens in the world. And in the Epicurean's mind, the gods don't have anything to do with the world, and it takes away from your pleasure if you're just constantly living in fear of the gods carrying out their wrath on you. So it's much easier to just believe that they don't have anything to do with us. And there are obviously modern parallels to that. It's much easier to believe that God isn't going to do anything about how you live. It makes life much easier. I can go out and do whatever I find pleasure in without worrying about some kind of divine consequence. So these ancient philosophies never died. They just kind of warped a little bit. But as I said, Paul addresses both of these in his speech at the Areopagus in Athens. We read in Acts chapter 17, verses 26 through 29. He made from one man every nation and of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their inhabitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. So, addressing the Epicureans, you know, God, he's much closer than you think. You can touch him, you can interact with him, you can know him. So, for in him we live and we move and we exist, as even some of your own poets have said, for we also are his children. Being then the children of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. So God is close to us. He is with us. We can reach out and touch him. And The Stoics are going, yeah, he is. There's God right here. Here's God right here. And here's Paul saying, no, we ought not to think of the divine as gold or silver or an idol or anything like that. He is a personal being. So we can see Paul addressing this even in the book of Acts. So we can see it was prevalent in their culture of the day. So anyway, and that moves us to Greek religion. They're related. Religion is always related to philosophy. There were various aspects of religion in those days. There were the traditional pagan religions. So they worshiped the pantheon of gods. And related to that was emperor worship, seeing the emperor as some kind of deity and offering worship to him. There were also the Eastern mystery cults were, they could be separated, or they could be attached in some ways to pagan religion, but we'll get into that. So anyway, pagan worship, this was the official religious system for Rome. Rome recognized that the gods were kind of in charge, the gods did things, and it had an effect on the world. Therefore, we need to render worship to these gods. We need to recognize them. And if we do that, then they'll bless us and they'll help us to become this great empire. The Roman gods were adapted from the Greek gods. So the Greek god Zeus was just renamed Jupiter. And there might have been minor differences between them, but the Roman pantheon basically just took the Greek gods and said, hey, we like this system, let's make it our own. They renamed them all, and those are the gods that they worshipped. And they received blessings through prayer, through sacrifices, seeking after God's will, divination, prophecy, and you know, not in the biblical sense, to where a prophet of God would hear God speaking and then relay that information. A pagan prophet wouldn't hear an audible voice, but instead he'd go out, gut a pig, dig around in him, and say, oh, this means this. So very odd, strange forms of trying to determine what the gods were saying. The worship of the gods, There's not really a parallel between the worship of the gods and our worship of God. It was more utilitarian for them. Well, we gotta honor the gods, and they'll take care of us. And we don't honor the gods, that's when bad things happen. So it's not out of, oh, I love these gods because of how wonderful they are. It's, well, I do my service to them, and then they might make my life better. We do our service to them as a nation, and they'll take care of us. That's how things have always worked, and that's how we're going to do it. And if things start going bad for the nation, well, that means someone isn't offering correct worship to the gods. And we'll see that with persecution as one of the primary reasons that Christians were persecuted. So the emperor was the high priest among the gods. The high priest in the pagan religion, a title Pontifex Maximus. If anyone knows anything about Roman Catholicism, that you'll recognize that as a title for the Pope, the Supreme Pontiff, later adapted by the Roman system for some strange reason. I think the person who thought that was a good idea didn't know their history very well. But anyway, the emperor was the high priest. He was in charge of the religion of the day. So, and pagan religion was ingrained in the culture. Everything you did had something to do with your religion. Yeah, because, you know, gods, there was a god for every single aspect of life. If you wanted it to rain, like, say, here, you know, we can pray for rain, obviously, but we recognize that God does things in his own time. But in their culture, the farmer is constantly praying to the rain god to send forth rain because, hey, that's just part of life. I want to rain. I got to render honor to the rain god, and it's with everything. So the gods were culturally ingrained into everything. Along with that comes emperor worship. So in the same way that the spread of the Roman Empire was attributed to the gods, they also saw a divine power in the emperor as well that helped that process along. So worship was rendered to not necessarily the emperor himself, but what's called the genius of the emperor, the divine power that stood beside and guided the emperor. So it's not like they looked at the emperor and said, "Oh, emperor, you know everything, you have so much power," but they recognized there is a some kind of divine power that was attached to the emperor, and thus they worshipped the genius, the divine power of Caesar. And some emperors even were promoted to official godhood after their death. Augustus, among other emperors, after they died, they said, "Oh, they went straight up to the gods. They're now part of the pantheon. Augustus is up there with Jupiter and everyone else." So the genius of the emperor isn't completely severed from the emperor himself in many cases. And throughout the empire, annual sacrifices were required. Generally, there was a fair amount of religious freedom. There were some religions that weren't allowed, but everyone had to perform this sacrifice. The Jews had a special exemption from it because they recognized that the Jewish religion was so much older, and they saw some value in that, and also the fact that the Jews just simply wouldn't do it, and it was easier to give them an exemption than to try to wipe them all out. So the Jews had an exemption, and the Christians enjoyed exemption from that as well for a time, until eventually the Jews and Rome declared that Christianity was not Judaism, and for various reasons, and Christians no longer enjoyed that privilege, and that also led to persecution, as we will see. So mystery cults, mention those a little bit. So this was worship rendered to gods that weren't found in the Roman pantheon. And so we've heard of gods such as Mithras and Isis and whatnot. So not necessarily part of the pantheon, but they were gods that people rendered worship to. And this was probably a little closer to Christian worship, because rather than it just being a utilitarian thing where, okay, render my honor to Zeus and Zeus takes care of us, the mystery cults had a more personal relationship with their deity in a way. They loved the deity, they wanted to be close to the deity, and so on and so forth, and it spilled into worship. Worship was very sensual. It was about stimulating the senses, so getting together and feasting and drinking and singing songs and dancing and going into trances and engaging in sexual debauchery in order to get closer to their god, to get in a closer relationship with their god. This is prevalent for us today, especially in apologetics, because there's a lot of ignorant people out there that hear of someone like Mithras and say, "Oh, well, Christians just copied off of these, and that's where Jesus came from. They took these various aspects of these mystery cults, they combined them together, and they made Jesus out of it. And Jesus, in reality, is no different from any of these. People just worship him for a lot longer." I have this little video that kind of refutes that some. So I just thought it'd be an interesting thing to play. All right, good. Let's see.
Did you know that Jesus is actually a ripoff of the pre-Christian god Mithras? According to skeptics, Mithras was born of a virgin on December 25th, had 12 disciples, promised his followers immortality, initiated a communion meal, called himself the Way, the Truth, and the Life, incorporated animal sacrifice, died for world peace, was buried in a tomb, and came back to life on the third day. Well, that sounds like Christianity, doesn't it? It's just too bad for skeptics. All of that is complete bunk. Mithras was a Persian god that predates Christianity by 1,400 years. That much is true, but as a religion, no Mithraic traditions popped up until the late 1st century. That's right, Mithraism is closer to being a ripoff of Christianity rather than the other way around. According to legend, Mithras was born of a rock. So much for being virgin-born. As for being born on December 25th, that's not Jesus' birthday, it's just the day it's celebrated. But Mithras wasn't born on December 25th either. The Emperor Aurelian chose that day to dedicate his temple to Sol Invictus, with whom Mithras shook hands. That's it. The rest of the Mithraic tradition showed up when New Testament canon was already in place. The idea that Mithras was a master with 12 disciples came even later than that. Mithras didn't sacrifice himself for world peace, never claimed to be a savior, and his death and resurrection are contained in no Mithraic writings. The end. Christ's death and resurrection is historical fact. It did not come from cleverly invented stories, but from those who were eyewitnesses to his majesty. The skeptics who refuse to leave their sin and follow Jesus stumble on the truth, as they were destined to do when we understand the text.
There. It's amazing the parallels that some people attempt to make between these strange gods that had very small followings and Jesus. Like you said, people who run around saying Mithras, oh, he was born of a virgin. Well, he came out of a rock. That's not necessarily virgin birth. And then there are others. People will say that such and such a god rose from the dead 3 days later, but if you look at the actual story, a tree sprouted up from where he died or something ridiculous like that. But people, it seems like falsehoods like to come around again, and people will do anything to try to refute Christianity. So anyway, mystery cults. And all right, so next up we're going to be looking at the Jewish world, but I think we'll save that until next time. Any questions over anything we covered? Comments? Herod. Yep.
And he died afterwards.
Yep.
So it's not surprising that they would do that, given that they have a tendency to make their rulers into deities pretty easily without much. In that particular case, they were ready to do it just because he made a great public speech.
Yeah, made a great speech, and probably had to do with his family following, the genius of Herod following him along, and it's by his divine power that he has such a wonderful empire, and then he's struck with worms and he dies. So much for that, I guess.
and it led to Paul being, they wanted to worship him as one of the gods too.
Mm-hmm.
Zeus or,
yeah. So, yeah, we could probably draw some parallels with the Middle Ages, where everything is a demon in the Middle Ages. Luther, he's swatting away at flies, and he says, oh, the demons are attacking me. So just everything was divine. It's not like it is today, where everything is more stoic today. Everything is just natural. There's no intelligence outside of us. This is it.
I also find it interesting
speaking to the king of Tyre. It's not the king himself, but he's speaking to ultimately the satanic power behind that.
And yeah.
It's interesting that there is they're off base in their understanding of it, but still kind of a recognition of the power that was ultimately behind the throne.
Yeah, and even the New Testament somewhere mentions how the worship rendered on these altars is worship of demons. So, sure, there might have been a power behind it, but it's an evil, wicked, demonic power posing as God, and that's ultimately what Satan wants, to pose himself as God. I think C.S. Lewis calls him the ape of God, tries to copy God and be like God. So, yeah. All right, anything else? Well, have a good night. We'll see you next week. We'll continue looking at the backgrounds. We'll get into the Jewish world, and then that'll lead us right into the New Testament, I think, and won't spend a terribly large amount of time there, and then we'll move from the Old Testament to we'll see the rise of persecution and how that played out. So thanks for coming tonight.